Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, April 15th, 2025, and our friend Scott Rader is back with us. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Last time we talked together with Larry Johnson, and we didn't know what would happen between Iran and the United States. Right now, we had the first round of talks, negotiations between the two parties. What's your assessment so far?
Well, this is what I've always been saying. This is the only path out. Nobody listened to me. Everybody thought it was a great idea for Iran to get a nuclear weapon and all that. Iran had no choice. The United States was prepared to use military force, and this military force would have been decisive. This is about the Iranians doing that which is necessary to survive as a nation state. Remind people that the Ayatollah Khomeini, to bring an end to the Iran-Iraq war at a time when he said he will not stop fighting till Saddam Hussein is removed from power for the crimes that were committed by the Iraqis invading Iranian territory, occupying their cities, brutalizing their people. He said this war will go on until Saddam is gone, but he has forced to accept ceasefire terms that he likened to drinking a cup of poison. The Iranians are drinking a cup of poison right now. They have no choice but to negotiate. But, you know, the Iranians, by standing up to the United States and putting the United States into this, boxing America into this corner where the only alternative for the United States was a war, which, if we were going to win, would require the use of nuclear weapons, which would make us a global pariah. I think Donald Trump finally woke up to the fact that he didn't want to be a global pariah. And that's why he softened his stance. He stopped talking about, stopped sending insulting letters to the Ayatollah Khamenei. He stopped talking about you have to get rid of, you have to cease your friendships with this. You have to get rid of this, that, and the other thing. And the only thing they're talking about right now is Iran's nuclear program and the military aspects of that program. And the Iranians are sitting down and listening because I believe there will be a compromise. I believe there will be a JCPOA type settlement that will be, reached between the United States and Iran. Whether this is able to be turned into a treaty or not, I don't know. But I think Donald Trump, as he campaigned on, doesn't want a war with Iran. The fact that he announced the departure of Steve Witkoff to Oman in the presence of Benjamin Netanyahu, who'd flown to the United States to get the United States to bomb Iran, shows you where Trump's heart is on this one. He doesn't want a war with Iran. The problem is the peace through strength mantra that the United States has adopted, where Trump feels a need to lead off with just ridiculousness, maximum pressure. That turned the Iranians off immediately from any potential negotiations. Then the insulting letter, that shut all doors. But the doors got open, as I said they would, because Iran was about to disappear as a nation state. And I think the Iranians understood that the United States was boxed into a corner, just like the Obama administration had been boxed in 2014, if you recall, where Obama had bought into the Israeli notion of not one spinning centrifuge. We're not going to allow one spinning centrifuge. And if you don't shut down everything, the military option's on the table. And the Iranians are like, okay, if you got to do it, you got to do it. And Obama's like, well, I don't want to do it. So next thing you know, they have secret negotiations that lead to the JCPOA. Not because the Iranians were begging for it, but because the Obama administration had boxed itself into a rhetorical corner. And the Trump administration has done the same thing here by leading off with maximum pressure, by threatening military force. When confronted by the fact that the Iranians weren't going to bend the knee, Trump softened. And as soon as he softened, the Iranians softened as well, because neither side wants a military action. And so we've gone down the only path available. There is no other path. Stop fantasizing about Iranian nuclear weapons and an Iranian nuclear deterrent. It will never, ever, 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 ever happen. Never. It can't happen. It won't be allowed to happen. The Iranians don't want it. They don't need it. And the United States won't allow it. It would be immediate nation termination event for Iran. One that might actually reduce the pariah status for the United States, because the United States will say, Iran has no right to a nuclear weapon, and they and therefore military action is, you know, legitimate. But thankfully, right now, we're not engaged in that kind of discussion. We had a successful meeting, according to both sides, a successful meeting between Wyckoff and the Iranian foreign minister. And I believe they're scheduled for another meeting later on this month. And Trump is, he needs to learn how to shut up his Secretary of Defense. That would be useful. But Trump himself is not beating the drums of war. He's talking about, you know, the potential of peace with Iran, a nuclear deal that focuses solely on nuclear, the potential of Iran to produce nuclear weapons. So I think we're in a much better place today than we were this time 2 weeks ago.
Scott, you've mentioned the Secretary of Defense. Here is what Pete Hegseth said on Fox News.
At direct talks yesterday, they began in the past. It's been indirect talks with a mediator, but there's Steve Witkoff meeting with the foreign minister of Iran. What can you tell us?
Well, I can tell you that President Trump is dead serious on this issue. He's dead serious that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. He's said that for 20 years. He's been consistent. That is clear. He's dead serious that he wants it done at the negotiating table. He wants it done peacefully. Yeah. And that's why he's going straight to these talks. He set that deadline. These were productive talks yesterday. I don't want to get ahead of our skis. Steve Witkoff does a fantastic job, but it was a good step, and they're going to go at it again on Saturday. But he's also dead serious that if we can't figure this out at the negotiating table, then there are other options to include my department to ensure that Iran never has a nuclear bomb. We hope we never get there. We really do, Maria. But what we're doing with the Houthis and what we're doing in the region, we've shown a capability to go far, to go deep, and to go big. And again, we don't want to do that. But if we have to, we will, to prevent the nuclear bomb in Iran's hands.
The problem, Scott, is not just Pete Hegseth. It's the Marco Rubio as well. And these people are not helping Donald Trump. They're somehow destroying everything that Donald Trump is working for, working on, and is planning for. And how do you see these people, and comparing them with Witkoff, with which I do believe that he has much more. They're talking about he's a businessman, he's not that much deep in the geopolitical issues, but after all, he's much more, he's wiser than these two people who are, who have the main positions in the Trump administration.
Where to begin? Look, we know that Marco Rubio is not Team Trump. We know that. Marco Rubio hates Donald Trump. We know that. So whatever transformation that's taken place for Rubio to become Trump's Secretary of State, this is cosmetic in nature. At the end of the day, Marco Rubio is Marco Rubio, a neoconservative to the core who wants war with Iran and doesn't want peace with Russia. That's his core value. And suddenly he's been called upon to front for different policy objectives. And this grates him. You look at his body language. I don't want to pretend that I'm some sort of, you know, expert on reading bodies, but I'm not bad. And his body language is just off. This is man that when Trump is talking about peace and all that, Rubio's in a defensive crouch. And then you see when he has a chance to come forward, you know, he comes in with an extreme interpretation of something. He's not supportive of this at all. The fact that Witkoff doesn't report to him, but instead reports directly to the president, you know, is part of the problem. Hegseth, very loyal to the president. There's no doubt about that. But he's a man totally out of his depth. I mean, they promoted a lieutenant colonel to serve in a job that should only be held by people that have four-star general experience. Now, I'm not saying they have to be four-star generals, but you need people that know how to manage large institutions and understand strategic thought. Hegseth was never a strategic thinker, never. He's an operational planner at best, a tactical guy. I mean, the fact that he gets off on going out and running with the troops shows you where his mind is. I mean, that's great. I'm sure the troops that he runs with love it. But, you know, Pete, you should actually be sitting back getting briefed on the big picture. So you wouldn't say stupid things like, we've gone deep, we've gone hard, we've gone big, in Yemen as a way of, you know, somehow threatening the Iranians. Because you haven't gone deep, big, hard in Yemen. You're not doing anything in Yemen. Pete, you took your two biggest bombers, put your two biggest bombs on the bombers. You flew them into Yemen and you dropped them against targets that were underground in nature, believing you could blow them up in a way to send a signal to Iran. And you didn't make a dent in them, Pete. American weapons aren't doing anything to the Yemeni underground. And now you're talking about flying deep into Iran and what, dropping those same bombs on Iranian targets that are even deeper. I mean, I wish the interviewer had asked Pete, since you don't have, and you acknowledge you don't have any conventional munitions capable of taking out Iran's buried nuclear facilities, what munitions are you allocating to this target deck that you speak so fondly of, Pete? Are you talking about using nuclear weapons against Iran, Pete? Because it sounds like you are. Is that really the mission that you've been given? The answer is yes. That's why Trump doesn't want to do it. So Pete should shut up. Literally, shut up. You don't have to say things, Pete. What you could say is, I stand by the president and everything he's trying to accomplish in Iran, and I will faithfully execute the orders given to me by the president. Right now, the president is focused on a diplomatic option that we in the Department of Defense think is great. Nobody wants to go to war, and we're hopeful that Steve Witkoff and his Iranian counterparts can find a solution to this problem. We're very supportive of it. We stand by to assist the president any way necessary. Huh. Did he say anything wrong there? Nope. Did he say the exact same thing that he said earlier, but without the implied threats or the implicit threats? Yes. But Hegseth can't think like that, because in his heart, he's still a battalion operations officer, a battalion commander at best. Who's thinking about taking the next hill, not thinking about how to solve the world. This man is out of his depth, and it's an embarrassment. He embarrasses America on a daily basis every time he opens his mouth, because you know he's not familiar with half the things he's now charged with overseeing. I mean, he has to, understand the briefing necessary to bring him up to speed. He doesn't understand the programs he's responsible for. He's making knee-jerk decisions, emotional decisions, and he's dealing with a man-child as the president who doesn't understand the military either, who is desperately relying upon the wisdom of his Secretary of Defense when it comes to these issues of war and peace. And instead, he has a baby there. So a baby is advising a man-child. This is not good. This is a bad thing. And it's the same thing with Rubio. I mean, these are two people that, come from different ideological perspectives, but at the end result, they're not doing either the president or America any good. But the real problem is Michael Waltz. See, Michael Waltz is a national security advisor. I'd have to ask myself why Rubio and Hegseth are so off message consistently. And the answer is there is no message. When was the last time the national security advisor called together all the principals to have a strategy meeting, to sit down and say, okay, let me give you the president's guidance. And then, have each one of the principals turn down to their deputies, and they hold a deputies meeting with the deputy national security advisor, who then says, okay, let's lock in how we're going to do this. So let's get our interagency planning groups together. Let's get it down there, get the agencies talking to each other. I want you guys to come back to me with consensus policy options in a week. And then the meeting come up, the deputies have their meeting. They all agree, yep, these are the consensus. They go to the principals and there it is. And then the principal can go to the president and brief the president. This is what we all agree upon. And now you have singular policy. That's how it's supposed to happen. Instead, you have this man child out there just going, I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that. And sometimes his instinct is good. Sometimes his instinct is horrible. Secretary of State should be telling the president, knock off this threatening stuff, because all it does is make you look bad. What happens if Iran didn't yield? Are you really going to go to war violating everything you say you stand for, Mr. President? But Rubio's not, because Rubio wants him to go to war. So Rubio's like, keep it up, Mr. President. Keep up saying stupidity so you fall and you fail. And Rubio secretly hopes Trump fails. In his heart of heart, Marco Rubio wants Donald Trump to fail so he can step in and say, I, as Secretary of State, saved America from this colossal disaster called Donald Trump, and I'm ready to be your next president of the United States. That's Marco Rubio's ambition. You think he's just going to stop at Secretary of State at his age? He's just going to sit there and go, this is it. This is as high as I go. No, man, this guy's going to be in the presidential race forever, forever. That's why he was bumped up to Secretary of State. So, you know, Rubio isn't going to be supporting Trump. Rubio's supporting Rubio. Hegseth, again, I think he's just tickled pink to be where he's at. But it's over for him. He's never going anywhere after this because he's a failure. I don't know if he's going to last 2 years because he's going to make fatal mistakes. Tragically, Americans are going to die because Pete Hegseth is incompetent, not up to the task. We saw this with the whole, with that Signal chat group where, Hegseth is sitting there throwing data around. No, don't do it. But there's no coordinated policy. So what happens is you have freelancers. You have Tulsi Gabbard out there trying to do her thing. You have J.D. Vance doing his thing. I think they're both on the side of Trump trying to do what's right for Trump when it comes to, fulfilling peace. You have Hegseth who just wants to go to war. That's all he wants to do. And you have Marco Rubio who just wants to be president of the United States. So he's going to undermine Trump at every chance he gets. And therefore you have no policy. You just have a president who wakes up every morning and tweets out. I mean, to be honest, instead of the national security advisor, calling people in and reminding them of the policy priorities that have been set and setting the agenda, everybody wakes up in the morning, goes to their social media and says, what did the president put out on, what is it, Truth Social that he's on? That's how we get policy in America. We have to wait for the president to tweet. Guys, that's not how it's supposed to work. That's not how it's supposed to work. And yet that's what's happening here. People are waiting for the president to tweet. This is a system that's out of control. And it will eventually come back to haunt the president. He may get one or two victories out of this, but unless he brings it under control, the competition that isn't being coordinated, it's okay to have a cabinet of people that don't get along. I mean, Abraham Lincoln famously put one together during the Civil War. People that didn't get along, but he managed it. And he had Secretary of State who managed these people and held them in. And we don't have anybody managing this Trump disaster right now. This is literally the most powerful ship in the world sailing on the ocean. And nobody's at the helm. It's just sort of going where it wants to go.
As you mentioned, I think the key is the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. I see him getting to the same path and just, it's so similar to what Mike Pompeo was. In the beginning, he was somehow coordinating with Donald Trump. Then he, as time went by, he just separated himself from Donald Trump and finally, he was one of the worst enemies of Donald Trump within the administration.
Yeah, that's Rubio right now. We just saw this morning Rubio, at a time when the president is, on Sunday, the Russians hit Sumy with two Iskander missiles. And according to the Russians, they hit a gathering of military officials, including some of the senior officers who were responsible for the invasion of Kursk back in August. It was an award ceremony. And the Russians killed about 60 of them and some of their Western advisors. And if this is true, this is a major victory for the Russians. Tragically, civilians died as well. The Ukrainians admit that there was a military award ceremony and that the official in charge invited civilians to be present. So this is sort of like a human shield kind of thing, whatever. Tragic, but it's war. But the Russians have sort of fumbled the information warfare aspect of this, expecting people to accept at face value what they say without providing any evidence to back up the, their assertions. And therefore they've opened the door for people in Europe and the Ukrainians to take control of the narrative. This is like Bucha all over again. Like Bucha, I knew the day Bucha happened, who did it. Everybody knew who did it because the Ukrainians broadcast who did it. You have the Safari unit on their webpage saying, we're coming in, we're going to cleansing operations. You have videos of them shooting people that don't have the right armbands on. You have a statement by the mayor, stay indoors. Don't worry about the shooting. It's just cleansing operations. Don't worry about it. So you knew what happened. And the Russians were like, no, that wasn't us. We were out of there. We were doing our thing. We were retreating. It's very bad. And then the Ukrainians, together with the West, put on this huge PR campaign and seized the narrative and used Bucha as an excuse not to implement the Istanbul communique. So what we have now is the Europeans and the Ukrainians trying to do the same thing, to use Sumy as an excuse to prevent Trump's, you know, peace plan with Putin, to bring it down. And this is a time when the Trump administration needs to rally around the president and only feed off the president's lead. Instead, he's getting horrible advice. And again, this president has diarrhea of the mouth. He doesn't know how to shut up. You know, so he says, well, this was a mistake. The Russians made a mistake. No, they didn't, Mr. President. They hit a target. And if you got briefed by your intelligence people, they tell you what the target is. But instead, you go with whatever is whispered in your ear and you're saying things. And now he's sort of backed away. He's not talking about that anymore, just the need to bring an end to this conflict. But Rubio, the disloyal person that he is now working with Keith Kellogg, who's an idiot, who at the same time that Steve Witkoff goes, I mean, Kellogg, again, how's this for team player? Witkoff flies to St. Petersburg, has a remarkable 3.5-hour meeting with Vladimir Putin, where they actually lay out in very stark terms what is necessary for Russia to move forward aggressively on peace. And it's basically total Russian control of the of five territories, Crimea, and then Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk. And if once you do that, the Russians, I think, will have some flexibility on the other stuff. But that's a prerequisite, non-negotiable, et cetera. So Witkoff comes back and goes, yeah, Mr. President, if we do this, I think we got smooth sailing. So what does Keith Kellogg do? Immediately publishes his stupidity of a map about partitioning Ukraine up into some sort of occupation zones with a 18-mile buffer zone and occupation forces. Who authorized that? And now you have Rubio working with Kellogg to work with the Treasury Secretary. Just in case this fails, Mr. President, we're ready to put on the, we're going to sanction him to death, Mr. President. We're going to give you a full range of options to hold Putin accountable for the failure. Well, the president ain't talking about failure. He's trying to work towards success. But this is Rubio, Kellogg, and the Treasury Secretary all undermining the president in public. In public. I mean, again, Donald, this is where the National Security Advisor needs to call them in and say, tell me why I shouldn't go to the president right now and demand your resignation. Because I'm going to tell you what, if you don't give me a good answer, I'm going in there. It's either going to be you or me. One of us is leaving here without a job. And it ain't going to be me. You traitorous son of a bitch. Why shouldn't I have you arrested right now for undermining the foreign policy of the United States? You know, just things like that. Just be right in their face. Keith Kellogg. Hey, guess what, Keith? Good news. We're bringing you back to be a four-star general. Put on your uniform. Bad news. We're court-martialing you for treason. You're deliberately undermining the policy of the President of the United States with unauthorized release of classified information. Whatever. I mean, do something like this. Hold these people to account. Take control. Take control of this situation. But don't let this go on, this act of betrayal of Donald Trump, because you're right. This is exactly what Pompeo and Bolton did in Donald Trump's first term. And Trump said he learned his lesson. Well, apparently not. Apparently not. We could have had an agreement with North Korea that could have led to denuclearization. At very minimum, North Korea wouldn't have ICBMs armed with nuclear weapons aimed at the United States. That would be a good thing. We could have had it, but Pompeo and Bolton stabbed the president in the back, stabbed him in the back, sabotaged it. Treason, literal treason. And now we have little Marco Rubio working with, you know, the Treasury Secretary and Keith Kellogg doing the same thing, stabbing Donald Trump in the back. And Mike Waltz isn't doing anything about it. Isn't taking control. This is a dysfunctional team, which may be the way that Donald Trump wants it. Maybe Trump is happy waking up in the morning, making everybody respond to his tweets, but that's not the way to run a country. And that's definitely not the way to manage the national security affairs of the world's most powerful nation.
I think one of the reasons that he's sending Witkoff to Iran, to Russia, to the Middle East, because he doesn't believe that these people are going to help him. And I don't know if he's that much serious. He's that much, he can just fire them and say, I don't need you. Well, he's going to keep up and just let them work with him until this administration is over. I don't know. Do you see him firing them, or he's going to just continue working with them?
I don't know. I mean, I would be surprised if Rubio survived. I think Rubio at best is a 2-year Secretary of State, and come midterm elections, he'll be jettisoned. Hegseth, I don't think he's going to make it. He's going to screw up. He's going to get fired. Waltz almost got fired. I mean, the president almost fired him over that Signal chat room debacle. The only person he trusts is Witkoff, you know, and because Witkoff is loyal. And Witkoff doesn't have competing agendas. Witkoff's not trying to be somebody. Witkoff is who he is. He's a friend of the president of the United States, who's here to do that which the president wants him to do. And he's executing the president's guidance flawlessly. And he's realistic, too. That's one of the problems, is that he's coming back with very, very, you know, reality-based policy options, which the president should run with, but instead he delays and hems and haws and allows an opening for Rubio and company to come in and stab him in the back. I think the president trusts Witkoff because he doesn't have an agenda. You know, I'm stunned at a couple things. One, Marco Rubio, your Secretary of State. And while you're sitting here coming up with stupidity to violate the constitutional rights of you know, non-U.S. citizens, believe it or not, they have constitutional rights, regarding, you know, this whole thing about Palestine, and, you know, you can't stand up against Israel. It's become a thought crime. If you think it, you get kicked out. And he's allowed the good name of America to become weaponized like this. And yet, according to the news, his State Department is going to take a massive cut, meaning that his ability to do diplomacy. So Marco Rubio is no longer the lead diplomat. Witkoff's the lead diplomat. And what Rubio should be saying is, Mr. President, Witkoff needs to coordinate with my team, or my team is going to be advising him and all this stuff. You know, but we have to know what's going on. We have to be present. We have to do something. But instead, Witkoff comes back to the president, who then, I don't know how he disseminates the information to little Marco. But Marco Rubio is presiding over a State Department that's about to become gutted at a time when we say that we want peace, at a time when we're talking about improving U.S.-Russian relationships across the board, which require, you know, the staffing up of embassies, the staffing up of the State Department. Instead, we're getting gutted. And not a peep out of Marco Rubio, not a peep. I mean, this is insane. We need more diplomacy. Pete Hegseth came in and talked about, you know, we're going to take a 5% cut in the defense budget for the next 5 years, or maybe a 7% cut. I don't know what it was, but it came up to basically at the end of 5 years, you'd have, you know, 40% cut. Now we're turning around. No, we're going to have a $1 trillion defense budget. Where's the cut? I mean, there's just a disconnect here. There's not consistency in policy, and it's bad for America. Again, leading with the fist and, you know, keeping the, you know, the velvet, you know, glove of friendship, you know, is being put off and put into a drawer. This is insane. Total wrong priorities. But there's no policy. That's the problem. And we can blame Rubio, but you knew what you're getting when you bought Mark Rubio. The problem is the president. The problem here is the president of the United States. He's a man child that has no discipline, and he's unable to assemble a team because he's never had to have a team. His whole thing is you're fired, the apprentice type. He's never had to control a team and make the team work together with common objectives. And he's brought people into his team that don't know how to do it either. Pete Hegseth, what the hell is he doing there? I mean, I have to be honest. If someone came to me and said, Scott, I want you to be Secretary of Defense, I said, no, you don't. No, you don't. I've never operated at that level. I could advise the Secretary of Defense on certain things, but to manage the Department of Defense, you know, an $900 billion to $1 trillion enterprise that has such complexity across the board. No, I can't be Secretary of Defense. You need somebody who's managed, a CEO or a four-star general, somebody with that large-scale management experience, who's familiar with the Washington D.C. bureaucracy, comfortable with, you know, how the system works. But you bring in me, you know, you're going to get, you know, a guy who, you know, on his best day commanded, you know, a couple hundred inspectors on the ground in Iraq. It was complex. It was difficult. I'm proud of the work I did, but that ain't the same thing as running a corporation or running a Department of Defense. And I know that. So, you know, why didn't Pete Hegseth just say, Mr. President, I'm not the man for this. Make me the Assistant Secretary of Defense for, you know, special operations and low intensity conflict. I could do that. But no, as the Secretary of Defense, Mr. President, I'm just not up to the task. I'll fail you, and I don't want to fail you. I want you to succeed. But he went with it. And he went with Marco Rubio as the Secretary of State, a man who literally doesn't believe in anything Donald Trump believes in. And now he's representing Trump and the United States as our nation's lead diplomat. This is just bad stuff. It's the president's fault, 100%.
Scott, here is what Witkoff said in his interview about the talks he has done with Iranians on Fox.
Peace through strength, it resonates throughout the world. It's the very good.
Oh.
This message of peace through strength, it resonates throughout the world. This is not a threat on my part now. It is just a simple fact. The president means what he says, which is, they cannot have a bomb. The conversation with the Iranians will be much about two critical points. One, enrichment. As you mentioned, they do not need to enrich past 3.67%. In some circumstances, they're at 60%. In other circumstances, 20%. That cannot be. And you do not need to run, as they claim, a civil nuclear program where you're enriching past 3.67%. So this is going to be much about verification on the enrichment program, and then ultimately verification on weaponization. That includes missiles, the type of missiles that they have stockpiled there, and it includes the trigger for a bomb.
Yeah, they're mostly, Scott, focusing on the nuclear bombs and the capability of hitting the targets by nuclear bombs. We know on the part of Iranians, when you look at the Iranian media and the way they're talking about, they started these negotiations because they just not negotiating for the sake of negotiations. They want something to happen for the sake of outcome of these negotiations. And we know that the Trump administration is looking for the same thing. They want to get the result as soon as possible. The two parties, they want a solution for the conflict, for this sort of conflict between the United States and Iran. And the way forward, if they achieve some sort of agreement, as you mentioned, like JCPOA, something like that, how the problem with Yemen, the problem in the Middle East would remain. How do they have any sort of strategy for that? Because the way that Pete Hegseth, as you mentioned, is talking about Yemen, it seems that Yemen doesn't exist. Yemen is just can be manipulated the way that he's talking about them. And we know that that's not the case. And there has to be some sort of strategy on their part.
Does there have to be? This is the Trump administration you're talking about. Does there have to be a strategy? I mean, if there was a strategy, again, I mean, I've sat in on meetings like this. You have to weigh out all your options and lay out the probability of success for each option. And right now, if we're talking about the problem of Yemen and Israel and the shipping, if I were briefing the president of the United States, I would say that the military option is our least desirable option. We don't have a solution to this problem based upon the resources allocated. Bringing more aircraft carriers into the theater isn't going to do anything other than increase the target deck for them to attack us. What we need to do is get the Yemenis to stop. There needs to be incentives. And right now there's only one. Ceasefire in Gaza. That's it, Mr. President. You want to stop the missiles? Ceasefire in Gaza. We had it. The Israelis violated it. You greenlit that violation. We need to go back and put the pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu and put the squeeze on it. Whatever Steve Witkoff did back in November of last year, we need to replicate that today and get the Israelis to stand down. Then the missiles stop, and now we've suddenly solved that problem. It's not there anymore, Mr. President. And then we can focus on how to deal with Gaza. And you might be amazed, Mr. President, that if you stop bombing Palestine and actually send humanitarian goods in and create an environment conducive to peaceful outcomes, that we might be able to get Hamas to agree to certain things. Hamas isn't going to agree to anything with bombs dropping on their head. They sort of proved that for 15 months. If you want Hamas to agree to things, if you want there to be some sort of consensus-driven compromise that has Hamas step aside as the lead and take up a subordinate posture in a joint Palestinian governing body that isn't called Hamas anymore, you do that by encouraging that outcome, by stopping to drop bombs, stopping the Israelis from dropping bombs. That's the solution. And you can't tell me that Trump's afraid to go against Israel, because he made Benjamin Netanyahu sit next to him as he did two things. He told Benjamin Netanyahu, we're not bombing Iran for you. And he also told him that you don't get a say over Gaza. At the end of the day, it's my harebrained scheme to depopulate, and it's going to be American land. We do this. You don't get a vote. You're out. And Netanyahu had to sit there with his stupid grin. And what could he do? Nothing. He'll go and he'll have his meeting with Rubio and everybody. He'll try and stab Trump in the back and, all that kind of stuff. But Trump can go against Netanyahu. It's not as though it's impossible for him to do that. And what's interesting, I'd love to have the Secretary of Treasury, tasked with saying, what would be required to bring Israel to its knees economically? Now, you could say, I'm looking at this from the standpoint, how do we prevent others from making that happen? Because the last time I checked, there were long lines of people queuing in Israel for food and goods because they have to ration, because the economy is fundamentally broken because of what Yemen's doing. But also, as the president, I'd like to be able to call up Netanyahu and say, hey, Bibi, I've listened one too many times to your stupid ass video where you talk about how you own America, you bought America, and we work for you. I want to remind you, Bibi, that we don't work for you, that you work for me. You may not know that you work for me, but I'm telling you right now, you work for me. And you're going to do everything I tell you to do, or I'm shutting you down. I'm shutting you down. I've got a list of five things here that I'm going to do. I can do overnight, and you're finished. You're politically finished, your government will collapse, and your nation may not survive. It's not doing too well right now, Bibi, and we could put the pressure on it. We used to be able to talk to the Israelis like that because we own the Israelis. We really do. I mean, this is like a spoiled child telling the parents that they work for him. As long as the parents want to listen to the spoiled child, then it looks like the spoiled child is in charge. Mommy, daddy, buy me an airplane. Oh, we don't want our baby to cry. We buy him an airplane. But the baby can't buy an airplane. Mommy and daddy have to buy the airplane. Mommy and daddy have to do everything. Israel's the baby. It's a spoiled, rotten brat. screaming and pouting. And he's got all the relatives on his side, and the relatives can call up and say, you got to buy the baby an airplane, do the baby. But at the end of the day, the baby can do nothing. That's Israel. They literally can do nothing without us. Nothing. They don't live without us. They don't survive without us. They don't function without us. But somehow we become a nation of, parents that have caved into the spoiled brat. But all you have to do is tell the brat no and mean it. And it's time we start doing that with Israel, because this is the national security of the United States that's at stake here. You know, why we're continuing this ridiculous bombing campaign in Yemen, because all it's doing is killing innocent, Yemeni civilians. It's not accomplishing its military task at all. Why are we doing this? Because the spoiled brat is holding a temper tantrum. Bring the brat into the room, pull off your belt, whack him on the ass a couple times, tell him to sit in the corner, shut up. And by the way, there's a ceasefire and humanitarian goods are flowing into Gaza again. It's that easy. It would happen overnight. It literally is the easiest thing in the world to do, but we can't, because we have people that have, they're not under the control of the Israelis. This is what I've been saying all along. This is about people using Israel to achieve political control here in America. You leverage Israel, you leverage the whole Israeli issue, the Holocaust industry, everything, and you turn it into, look what's happening here in the United States. Thought crime. If I'm a foreign student, I wake up in the morning and I have a thought, gee, wouldn't it be nice to have a free and independent Palestine? The Israelis are Zionists. I'd better not articulate that thought in any way, shape, or form. Suddenly I'm a threat to the United States of America, and off I go. I'm done. Thought crime. You're an enemy of America if you speak ill about Israel. How does that work? It's because people, that this is a tactic not about defending Israel, but about controlling America. This is it. This is the mechanism to control the American people. The Constitution's being eroded. Our freedoms are being eroded. Everything's being eroded. And remember, this is the president who signed executive orders. I believe in free speech. I will defend free speech. I will not weaponize. Hell, you just turned the Department of Justice and the State Department into the biggest damn weapon oppressing free speech in the history of the United States of America. And you're ignoring the courts. Separate but equal branches. I mean, if I hear one more person say, well, the courts aren't the president. They never meant to be the president, you moron. They're meant to be a check and balance to executive power abuse, which is happening right now. Happening right now. And we have a Congress that's just punted. They don't exist anymore. Because Congress is the other thing. Checks and balance requires two against one so that one can't arise. But right now, the president's Congress is sleeping, and the courts, the president, I mean, because it comes down to Andrew Jackson. You know, when the Supreme Court, I think, countered him on the Trail of Tears. He said, good, tell him to enforce it. The Supreme Court can't enforce anything, nothing, squat. So we have a president just telling the Supreme Court to pound sand, and Congress isn't doing anything about it. And they're using Israel and anti-Semitism as the mechanism to achieve total control. Look what they're trying to do, shut down universities. I'm not the biggest fan of what Harvard and Columbia and Yale have turned into. You know, I especially when I speak of Russophobia and the role that academia plays in sustaining that, and how they become a tool of the deep state and all that. That's all that. But they have the president, the executive branch, dictating academic policy to academic institutions and threatening them with not just financial disaster, but to send actual armed agents in and pull people out. This isn't the America that I put on a uniform to defend. I don't defend an America where jackbooted face mask thugs pull people off the street for the crime of writing an op-ed piece. Hey, Marco Rubio, if you're scared of an op-ed piece, you're not much of a man to begin with. In the battle of ideas, when people have the courage to put their ideas out there, your response should be better ideas. you shouldn't be afraid of a debate. But when you collapse down to where you have jackbooted thugs seizing people, shipping them off, violating their rights, due process, hell, seize them in New York, send them to Louisiana to some dumbass judge who will sign anything because she's too stupid to live. I mean, this isn't the way our system's supposed to work. They're gaming the system because they're scared. Because at the end of the day, you can't defend Israel logically. There's no logical defense for genocide. There's no logical defense for Zionism. But what they've done now is they've elevated these crimes so much, and then they said, you can't criticize it. That's anti-Semitism. And if you criticize it, you're now anti-American. We've equated Zionism with American values. This is the death of America. Right here in front of us, we're watching America be eviscerated before our very eyes. And it's a travesty, but Israel doesn't control anything. This isn't being done by Israel. This is being done by Americans to control America. And you can't blame it on the Jews. Oh, there's Scott blaming everything on the Jews. No, the majority of the people doing this are evangelical, you know, Christian Zionists. It ain't the Jews doing this. It's Christians doing it. Because at the end of the day, Christians are fully capable of being every bit as fascist and anti-American as anybody. But this is a very dangerous period in the history of America. It's not about Russia, Ukraine, or Iran, Iran and all that. Hell, we've been in situations where we've almost gone to war before. It's about what's happening internally. We've never faced a threat like this. We've never faced a threat like this. And we don't have a solution to it. The American people are cowed into submission. We're fundamentally divided. That's part of the genius of this whole operation, to divide America so that when those who speak out now against what Trump is doing, you're told, oh, you've got the Trump delusion scenario, your derangement scenario, TDS. So you're just against Trump. You're just upset Trump won. Well, what if I voted for Donald Trump, supported what he claimed to be doing, and am vociferously opposed to what he's doing constitutionally right now? Do I have TDS? Am I somebody who just doesn't want Trump to say, I want Trump to succeed like you've never seen, because I believed in his platform of peace, but I'm not willing to sacrifice the essence of America to achieve whatever the hell Donald Trump wants to do, because whatever Trump's doing globally, we'll eventually have another president, and foreign policy changes and all that. I'd love to see us have lasting good relations with Russia. I'd love to see us get better relations with China, great relations with Iran. I'd love to see all that, and I hope it happens. But not at the expense of losing free speech and a free press here in America. Not at the expense of creating the thought police, which is what ICE and the State Department have become. When you have people scouring the social media to see if you've tweeted anything mean about Israel and using that as a determining factor whether or not you get to be in the United States, that's problematic. Free speech is free speech. And we don't have it anymore. It's under assault right now.
In the meeting, Scott, that you mentioned, that Donald Trump said that the United States is going to talk with Iran, negotiate with Iran. We've been witnessing that Netanyahu wasn't that comfortable next to Donald Trump. And he said something amazing, that he would agree if they can achieve something like what they have achieved with Libya. Here is, I don't know if you had the time to watch the Tucker Carlson interview with the former congressman Kurt Weldon. Here's what he said about Gaddafi.
Back from Gaddafi offering to resign. The U.S. didn't want him to resign. They wanted to kill him.
Why?
Because Gaddafi, and I met him three times. I took Biden on my second trip to Libya, by the way. He went with me when I spoke to the whole country. And every meeting I had with Gaddafi, he wanted two things. He wanted to unite the African continent into a group of nations economically, like European standard, gold, like the European economy. He wanted to base it on the gold standard. And the U.S. and Europe didn't want that. And the other thing is, they wanted control of his oil and they wanted control of his sovereign wealth. So Gaddafi had to go. That's outrageous and it's wrong.
This is Tucker Carlson, Scott. We know that he supported Donald Trump. People like Tucker Carlson, they are hoping that Donald Trump can bring some sort of change. And while we know that Netanyahu is just looking for those old policies that would benefit him, how do you see the way that these people who are important, who are substantial, who are so much to the core of the main supporters of Donald Trump, asking for these sort of changes like Tucker Carlson? And on the other hand, Netanyahu was trying to push the way that he wants the United States to act.
Well, first of all, we need to point out that what Netanyahu is referring to when he wants a Libya solution is Libya circa 2003. He wants the United States to eliminate Iran's nuclear program as we eliminated Libya's total capitulation by Libya, etc. Listen to what Kurt Weldon said. There was no talk about weapons of mass destruction or anything. These are two totally separate events. You can't link the two. You can't say this is a continuation. You had a unique set of circumstances in 2011 where, you know, Libya was threatening. I mean, the other thing that Weldon mentioned is Sarkozy and the corruption of Sarkozy, where Libyan business were funding Sarkozy's campaign and they were holding that over Sarkozy as blackmail. There were a whole bunch of complicated issues here that had nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, everything to do with corruption and politics. And Gaddafi was inconvenient to the corruption of France, to the corruption of Italy, to the corruption of the United States. And so, you know, we wanted to kill him. We wanted to get rid of him because he was a threat, not because of weapons of mass destruction or anything, but because of the politics of it'd be the equivalent of, slaveholders in the South, saying it's okay for Nat Turner to have risen up and liberated a chunk of the South and he can live outside the boundary. No, Gaddafi, you're a slave to America, a slave to the system. And we're not going to allow you to declare yourself free and independent and able to do this. You're a slave. You sold it. You bent the knee. You kissed the ring. You know, you belong to us. You march to our beat. And now you're rising up saying, no, you want a gold standard African currency. You've got bribery held over Sarkozy's head. Your oil is your wealth. You can't let slaves behave like that. So you kill them. That's what we did. I think Kurt Weldon's only touching on the complexity of the situation, the lies they were told, the deliberate lies, the whole genocide thing. The Libyans are committing genocide. No, they're not. Nobody's saying they are. There's no evidence for this. You're just making it up. It's like, you know, cop coming up. I got a Diet Coke in my hand. He said, drop the gun. I don't have a gun. Drop the gun. I don't have a gun. Drop. Kill me, you know. And that's what happened to Libya. You know, they just stop committing genocide. I'm not. Stop committing genocide. But we're not. Stop committing genocide. Bomb, 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 bomb. It was a lie. Everything about it was a lie. Hillary Clinton, again, she belongs in jail. You know, you remember? We came, we saw, he died. The cackle of a just, but she's Secretary of State. You don't just say these things out of the blue. And maybe she does because she's deranged, but there is something there that drove her to that. And Kurt Weldon's right. We wanted him dead. We didn't want to give him any options. This was, you know, death by cop. A cop was going to kill you no matter what. You know, it doesn't have to be a gun. All the cop has to say is there is a gun. There didn't have to be genocide. All we had to do is say there is genocide. Today, everybody acknowledges that the genocide thing was just made up. Didn't happen. They can't even assemble a case of, well, we had good reason to believe at the time. They can't even do a whole Iraqi WMD thing. You know, well, you know, inspectors weren't on the ground, so we didn't know, so we just believed that. Nope. We never had any evidence of genocide. We just ran with that so we could bomb them, so we could kill them. And that's what they did. So that's what Netanyahu is trying to talk about, the bending the knee aspect of it, not the killing the regime aspect of it. So I think we have to be careful when we talk about, you know, Netanyahu's Libya scenario. But again, the insulting nature of that. You know, Libya tried to get nuclear weapons in violation of international law. Iran's complied with the NPT. You know, that's what gives Iran the negotiating strength that they have, is that they've done nothing wrong. You know, so we, you know, we have to be careful coming in making demands. Logically, you and I have talked about this, and I know I get a lot of people pissed off when I say, but Iran has no need for anything other than 3.75, you know, to 5%, let's say, enrichment. There's no need, none whatsoever. And anything above that, you have to say, well, why are you doing it? They don't need 20% anymore because they've produced all the 20% in the world they need to make fuel plates. They have fuel plates that outlive the reactor, the Tehran research reactor that they have. 60%, there's no reason whatsoever unless you want to be a threshold state. And I got Dr. Morandi to admit that's exactly why they did it, to have leverage. Well, that's a dangerous game you're playing there. To have leverage means that you have a potential of developing a nuclear bomb right now, which is the red flag to the American bull that will get us to gore you, i.e. drop nuclear bombs on you and kill you. And Iran knows this. Iran knows that their position is indefensible, which is why Iran's willing to negotiate, and I believe bring it down to 3.75%. Missiles is a different issue. I don't see the Iranians giving up their missiles. If I were the Iranians, I would say, you know, every missile that penetrated the Iron Dome was a conventional missile, and so we're going to keep all of them. If you have a specific missile that you're interested in, maybe we can work out an inspection. You're worried about, you know, specific you know, capacitors. I don't know if there is that additional syllable in there. Yes, capacitators that are used, you know, for, you know, to detonate a nuclear weapon. Apparently, we have some concerns over this. I think it's related to some things that come out of the IAEA, meaning that it's dual use capable. The Iranians have provided explanation. But if you're worried about that, something can be worked out about that. If you're worried about a specific warhead design, I'm sure something could be arranged where the warhead was subjected to, you know, inspection and scrutiny to determine that it didn't. There's a deal to be made here. There really is a deal to be made here. But it's not going to involve Iran giving up its ballistic missiles. When I spoke with President Raisi in September of 2003, I addressed that question specifically. I said, you know, where is your deterrence? You know, you say you don't want a nuclear bomb, so there's no nuclear deterrence, which means then it's going to be conventional based, which is your ballistic missiles, but you haven't declared a ballistic missile deterrence policy, what the consequences of, you know, violating Iranian sovereignty will be. They have done so now. Operation True Promise 1 and True Promise 2 is the manifestation of a declared report, but it's what they are going to do. So we now know that Iran's deterrence is its ballistic missile capabilities, which have been proven to be capable of defeating the Israeli Iron Dome. They can defeat anything the United States has in the region. This is their conventional deterrence. They're not going to give that up, nor should they be asked to give that up, especially not in a vacuum. I mean, if I were going to make a bid for Iran's missiles, I'd say, what if we get Israel to give up their nuclear weapons? Iran might be able to do something there. But even then, you don't want to give up that which scares the crap out of everybody. And Iranian missiles do scare the crap out of everybody because they're very capable missiles. So there's a deal to be made here, but it's going to require flexibility on both sides. Iran's going to have to bite the bullet on the nuclear program. And they're going to have to get rid of things that they don't want to get rid of, downsize. Witkoff hit it on the head. I've been saying this all along. You know, people get mad when I say it, but when Witkoff says it, it's genius. That Iran has to appropriately size its nuclear capabilities to that which it needs. It can't have excess capabilities. Iran knows how to build centrifuges. So if Iran develops more nuclear reactors that require fuel, and Iran's not going to get the fuel from Russia, and instead Iran opts to make its own fuel, then Iran can, you know, size up. And install centrifuges based upon, because nuclear reactors aren't built overnight. So if you sign off on the nuclear reactor, you go to the IAEA and say, okay, at the same time, we're going to be bringing up the following centrifuge halls. We're going to time it so that, you know, the centrifuge halls are here. They're producing the fuel so that when the reactor is ready to be fueled, we have sufficient fuel ready to go in the reactor. So it's all part of a scheme. See, that's appropriately sized nuclear program. I think that that is the best Iran can hope for, is an appropriately sized nuclear program. That's so much better than Obama's not one spending centrifuge, by the way. It respects Iranian sovereignty. It allows Iran's, you know, scientific base to continue to exist, not shut it down. But it also alleviates the concerns. And I know the Iranians get mad when I say this, but the moment you said you're a nuclear threshold state, you made a fatal mistake. Because that means we're always going to view you as a nuclear threshold state. Always view you as a nation that has at least thought about leveraging nuclear capability into a potential nuclear weapon. And that's why you've got to be downsized. That's incompatible with any notion of regional peace and security. Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. They're not allowed to have one. They say they don't want one. So why put yourself in a position where you can leverage nuclear capacity into a potential nuclear weapon? Unacceptable. Again, the entire internet's going crazy right now. Scott Ritter's insane. He's screw you guys. Because if you were right, there wouldn't be negotiations right now. You're wrong. I'm right. There are negotiations because that's the only way out of this. It's the only way out of this. And Iran knows that. But it's up to Trump also to be realistic here. That's why I like Steve Witkoff, because he will be realistic. He will listen. You know, who could have thought? Could you imagine Joe Biden, anybody in the Biden administration coming back after meeting with the Russians? First of all, even meeting with the Russians, but coming back and saying, hey, Mr. President, Mr. Biden, all we have to do is give the Russians Crimea, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk, and everything will be okay. And by me going, well, we can't even consider that. That's outrageous. Why are you even bringing it up? Witkoff's realistic. So just the same way, he I think, will come back and tell Trump, I can get you a deal that gets it down to 3.65% appropriately sized nuclear program. We're not going to get rid of their missiles, but we might be able to get some inspection-based stuff in there to, you know, deal with the military aspect, you know, any transition. Because, again, the Iranians are their own worst enemy. When you say that you're a nuclear threshold state, when you have officials saying within a matter of weeks we can bring all the pieces together to create a weapon deployed on a missile, that means you've done some work on the warhead. It means you've done some work on the warhead. You know it means you've done some work on the warhead. We know it means you've done some work on the warhead. So those warheads can no longer exist. So it's going to require some work on that aspect. But I think a deal's there. A deal's ready. And both sides want this deal because the alternative is bad for everybody. Bad for the United States, bad for Iran, bad for the region, bad for the world.
Yeah. Scott, here is what Witkoff said about his latest meeting with Vladimir Putin.
I this is the third meeting I've had with him. This last meeting lasted close to 5 hours. We had two of his key advisors in the room at the time, Ushakov and Kirill Dmitriev. And it was a compelling meeting. This peace deal is about these so-called five territories, but there's so much more to it. There's security protocols. There's NATO, NATO, Article 5. I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of detail attached to it. It's a complicated situation from, you know, rooted in you know, some real problematic things happening between the two countries. And I think we might be on the verge of something that would be very, very important for the world at large.
Yeah. He shows that the way that he's talking about the negotiation, the talks, that it shows how deep Russia is talking with them and how they're getting to the root of the problem. And do you, he's optimistic about the future of the talks, but how do you see it so far? Do you think that can we have a deal with Iran, with Russia? That would be hugely beneficial for Donald Trump and his administration if he can do that. In case of you, as you remember, we talked about the situation in Ukraine before Donald Trump came into power. You said that the easiest conflict to be solved is Ukraine. And here is, we are talking about Ukraine. And how do you see the way that Donald Trump is dealing with?
Again, by allowing Witkoff to take the lead, it's a very good step. It'd be nice when Witkoff brings his message back that there was a national security team ready to receive this message and staff it and act upon it and such. They're not. I mean, there's a disconnect between the State Department, Department of Defense, even within internally. Are we providing intelligence support to Ukraine? Are we continuing to ship weapons? Are we continuing to sanction Russia? Because these are different mindsets. If your mindset is how to sanction Russia, then you're not thinking about the economic opportunities that Witkoff talked about. And Kirill Dmitriev is brought in for a specific reason. You know, he's not the security guy. He's not talking about Ukraine. He's talking about post-Ukraine, how the United States will benefit from a relationship with Russia, what the opportunities are for our two nations to work together. And this is important stuff. Ushakov, on the other hand, he's the security guy. I mean, he's the advisor. But Ushakov's job's made easier. Again, just to remind everybody, the peace deal is already done, Nima. It's done. It's called the Istanbul Communique. And the Ukrainians already agreed to things in there. They were ready to sign off on that in 2022. All Putin said is that there are new realities. What are those new realities? The five territories. Those are the new realities. When Witkoff says, we solve the five territories, we have a peace deal, it's because the Russians have said, you do that, the peace deal that was on the table ready to go is the one we'll go with. All those details in there. Now, Europe doesn't like that, so they're coming back with some counterproposals and they're complicating the thing. But again, if Trump took the bull by the horns and literally just said, yep, we've come to a deal with Putin. It's basically the Istanbul Communique, updated five territories. This is the peace agreement. Thank you, Vlad. We got it from here. Zelensky, get the hell out of here. You're fired. Bring in somebody new. You're signing this. You don't have any options. Europe, shut up. Literally that. I mean, I can shut up this future chancellor of Germany in a heartbeat. They shut him up instantly. Hi. Yeah. Look at the U.S. Embassy. Can you see it? You see the flag going down? Yeah, we're done. We're unplugging. We're finished with you. Until you leave, until the German people eject you, we have no relations with you anymore. You're an enemy of America, and we're going to treat you as an enemy of America from now on, because what you're doing is opposing a peace that is essential to our national security. We've deemed you to be the number one threat. Hey, German Parliament, we're sort of serious about this. Check your banks. We've shut them down. We've shut everything down. Oh, yeah, your diplomats, they've all been arrested. We had the FBI storm the German embassy because you are an enemy of America now. We've arrested everybody, and we're putting them on airplanes, flying them to a neutral third-party country. You want to play ball? Let's play ball, because that's where we're at right now. Germany thinks they can oppose us. How? How do they think they're going to do this? How do they not understand that they're promoting World War III? I mean, this is what I'm trying, your audience goes, Scott, that's just ridiculous. Guys, we're talking about World War III here, literally. Okay, this is the end of every, it's not a joke anymore. We have a chance for peace. The treaty's already been written, agreed to by the Ukrainians once, updated now to reflect current reality. A simple update, Ukraine's lost those territories. They're never going to get them back. Russia will, I assume, make some certain compromises on the other aspect of it. That's what Witkoff was talking about, Article 5, not Article 5, da, 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 da. there can be some compromise there, but Russia's going to get the territories. The war's going to end. No NATO in Ukraine. We're done. War's over. Why we can't tell Europe that? Why do we keep sending people to Europe who give contradictory signals? Why do we allow Keith Kellogg to even leave the United States, take his passport? Trust me, guys, it works. You take their passport, they can't travel. I know. Shut it down if you don't like what they're doing. Tell Hegseth to stop traveling and shut up. I don't want to hear another word out of your mouth, Pete, except the following. Our policy is peace. Go to Ramstein and tell them, we're done. Shut it down. Ramstein belongs to us. It's a joint base. All you foreigners, get off of it. Germany, we occupy. I want to remind you, we beat you in World War II. We're still an occupying power. And that's the status. Fact is, why don't we exercise our occupying power status and shut your whole damn country down? Because you're doing things that are insane. You're doing things that are threatening not just regional peace and security, but global peace and security. America could do this. We could. I mean, this is the kind of stakes that we're at right now. Instead, we just send these contradictory signals. Germany's talking about sending Taurus missiles to Ukraine to facilitate deep strike. Why are we allowing this to happen? People say, well, Scott, this is extreme. We blew up Nord Stream 2. How extreme do you want to get, guys? I mean, we've shown what we're capable of doing when our national security interests are on the line. This is dangerous stuff. Germany is out of control, literally out of control. And yet we're letting it happen. We should tell the French the same thing. No, you're not putting any troops in your in Ukraine. We won't tolerate it. go to the Romanians and say, shut the French bases down now. Who has more leverage over Romania, France or America? Ask the Romanians. Who can shut down their economy tomorrow, France or America? So the Romanians will do what we want. We could just tell the Brits and the Romanians, you don't get to operate out of it. Go to the polls and say, you like Fifth Corps where it's at? Then tell the Brits and the French they ain't coming through Poland either. And we could shut the Baltics down and immediately pull all American troops out of the Baltics and tell them that, if you continue to do stupid things, you lack Article 5 protection. I mean, Article 5 is for nations that are acting in conformity with NATO policies. If you're out there doing your unilateral thing, then like Turkey going into Syria, you're on your own. Turkey's a NATO member, went into Syria, Russia bombed them. Turkey didn't get Article 5 protection because that's a non-NATO thing. So just tell the Balts, whatever stupidity you're doing to Russian tankers, that's on you, man. That's on you. NATO ain't going to be there for you. And it's time for us to become large in NATO. What I mean by that is to stand up and say, we own you. We control you. Rutte, sit down and shut up. The fact is, Rutte, you're out of here. Let's show our true power. Fire him. Call NATO and say, Rutte's done. Let's get another person in here because we're the boss. We're the puppet masters. You're the puppets. This is what we need to do if we truly want peace, is bring NATO under control and bring Europe under control. And say, no, you don't get to start World War III. But instead, we just go forward and we give contradictory signals. We're either strong, we're weak, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do this. And Europe, they feed off of this. I want to remind everybody that Europe did this once before. From 2017 to 2021, I guess, Europe rode out 4 years of Donald Trump. It was a concerted strategy facilitated by Pompeo, Bolton, and the other deep state guys. But their whole job was to tie Trump up so he couldn't do his thing. That's what Europe's doing right now. This is a repeat of that strategy. This is the tie Trump up strategy. Trump said he learned from the first administration. Well, then where's that knowledge? Where's the knowledge? You got to shut it down, boss, or else the same thing's going to happen. You're going to get so tangled up. Not just by the Europeans and the Ukrainians, but by the traitors in your own ranks, the Pompeos, the incompetent people in your ranks, the Hegseths, Waltz, the fact that you surrounded yourself with neoconservatives who don't want anything that you're trying to accomplish. You know, the Secretary of Treasury, the Secretary of State, and the National Security Advisor don't want peace with Russia. They don't. And yet Trump picked them. There they are. It's crazy.
Just to wrap up this session, Scott, who's negotiating? Who's talking with European? Is it Witkoff? Or Marco Rubio? Because I don't see Marco Rubio being capable of... You've just mentioned the main agenda.
Witkoff doesn't have a European portfolio. Witkoff flies to Moscow, flies to St. Petersburg, flies to Oman, you know, then comes back home and briefs the president. But he doesn't go on a feel-good tour in Europe trying to tell people what's going on because he works for the president of the United States. This is Marco Rubio's job as the lead diplomat. And he should be working in concert with, you know, Pete Hegseth. No, but Hegseth should understand that the military arm doesn't lead. The military arm supports. And so the Secretary of State should be going in and setting, you know, the policy mandate. And then Hegseth should back it up. And it should be coordinated policy. Again, they shouldn't be making it up as they go along. This shouldn't be about a speech writer writing a speech that you're going to give the day before to announce policy. That speech should be actually a product of, you know, well-staffed proposals on what we want to accomplish so that every word in that speech leads to a policy objective that people are ready to act on, that people are pushing for. But instead, everybody's just waiting for the speech. And then he speaks and we go, what does that mean? What does that mean? Because almost as soon as he gives his speech, J.D. Vance gives another speech in Munich. What does that mean? What does that mean? And then Marco Rubio comes out and says some things. And what does that mean? And that's the whole Trump administration. Nobody knows what any of this means. And all you have to do, though, I mean, the good news is just wait 24 hours. It'll be overcome by events. He'll say something else, something stupid. And so what you were worried about yesterday, you're not worried about anymore because something else is out there. But that's not how you make good policy. And this is why you set yourself up for being exploited by Europe, by NATO, and by your enemies. Because they have met. They are meeting. What the hell do you think is happening every time, you know, Macron assembles the crowd there? Before that assembly happened, their staffs are working things out. They come in with point papers. They know what they want to accomplish. They are speaking with a single voice. They're doing everything that we're not.
Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thanks for having me.